We are now going to begin Letter 18, Part 3, and this is on page 268 in the Elias edition. Little by little, there came into the hands of the people a work, and this refers to the Shulchan Aruch, originally intended only as a compendium for scholars, which presented the latest results of Talmudic scholarship, purely with the view for their practical applications. It was primarily an extract differently arranged from the systematic work of the Rambam, and it highlighted the role of the Rambam as the great preserver of Torah observance in the times of overwhelming Gullus oppression. Unfortunately, however, the people became familiar almost exclusively with only one part of this work, the one containing the categories of Eidos and Avoda, the laws of divine worship, and the holidays. All other duties are dealt with in the other sections of this work, which, in accordance with the overall purpose of the work, were left for scholars rather than the general public. And so gradually, here and there, arose the unfortunate opinion that Judaism is marked only by praying and keeping the holidays with no relevance to life. So let's discuss this paragraph a little bit. If we look at Rav Hirsch's letter that he wrote to his cousin, Z.H. May, who we mentioned before, he decries the fact that the Shulchan Aruch was divided into four volumes, and only the first, Aruch Chaim, was, or is, learned. And this led people to believe that being a Jew involves only praying, fasting, and holidays. So if we look in this letter, which can be found at the end of Diane Grunfeld's introduction to the Chorev, he writes, "I should like to see," and these are of Hirsch's words, "I should like to see the Chorev appear in one volume, so that what is one in concept should also appear as one in expression. For the dividing up of our duties into various compartments has done great harm in the minds of people. One could write a whole treatise on the damage which has been done and is still being done by the fact that the Shulchan Aruch did not appear from the very beginning in one volume. That is how it came about that many a person has thought and still thinks that he is a perfect Jew if he merely observes the laws of Aruch Chaim, because usually only that part of the Shulchan Aruch got into people's hands. A good deal in Yaradea, and even more in Chosha Mishpat and Evan HaEzer, was neglected." I always found it a little bit ironic that the version of Chorev that was put out in English by Cincino Press was in two volumes, but I do think they were put out in one shot as opposed to as separate installments. So I think Rav Hirsch would have been okay with that because he actually discusses the publication and he says it should be done in installments, which would make the purchase easier. But either way, this idea that it should be one volume so that it should appear as one in expression is a window into the idea that we are so enwrapped in Aruch Chaim and not as much in the other three volumes of Shulchan Aruch. If you consider all these various influences, you will be able to understand how Judaism looked about 80 years ago, as well as all the developments that followed. Now, 80 years ago is around 1756. This is during the 18th century, and Moses Mendelssohn is on the scene at this point. At that time, when the yoke of oppression began to be lifted, which refers here to the Age of Enlightenment, which we've discussed, and as a result of the French Revolution, there was freedom for all types of people, regardless of religion, etc., and man's logic became in the forefront, which dictated his actions. So again, at that time, when the yoke of oppression began to be lifted, and the spirit felt freer to stir, there emerged once again a most brilliant and respected personality whose commanding influence has dominated developments to this day. This personality had not derived his freer spiritual growth from Jewish sources. He was chiefly great in the philosophical disciplines of metaphysics and aesthetics, and he viewed the Bible only philosophically and aesthetically. Thus, he did not develop the study of Judaism on the basis of its own premises, but merely apologetically defended it against political stupidity and pietistic Christian challenges. Personally a practicing Jew, he showed his brethren and the world that it was possible to be a strictly religious Jew and yet to shine highly respected as a German Plato. Okay, so before we see the footnote here and further in the 19 letters, so let's discuss Moshe Mendelssohn a little bit. And we're going to start with Diane Grunfeld. This comes from a book called Three Generations, The Influence of Rav Hirsch on Jewish Life and Thought, on page 17. In this connection, it is very tempting to compare Samson Raphael Hirsch with another man of destiny in the history of German Jewry as far as the impact of general culture on Judaism is concerned, Moses Mendelssohn. It is interesting and important alike to try to explain why Jewish history has treated these men so differently. While the disciples and spiritual heirs of Rav Hirsch landed finally in the yeshiva, the children and grandchildren of Moses Mendelssohn and many of his disciples ended in assimilation and at the baptismal font. While Mendelssohn's commentary on the Torah, the famous Bir, was put into Cherem by the Gedolei HaTorah, the commentary of Rav Hirsch was hailed by them as a great contribution to the true understanding of the Word of God. And all this in spite of the fact that the Bir was written in Hebrew and the commentary of Hirsch in German. No one can deny or has ever denied the purity of Mendelssohn's intentions, the integrity of his character, his personal piety, and meticulous observance of our laws. How then can we explain the different fate and appreciation of these men in the Torah-true Jewish nation? This is a most interesting question, and the correct answer to it is of great importance to the understanding of traditional Judaism in the post-emancipation era. Mendelssohn, it is true, stood within orthodoxy, and he also stressed emphatically, especially in his book Jerusalem, the necessity of observing the mitzvos. But he exalted the aesthetic and philosophical side of the Bible at the expense of the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, which is the soul of the Torah. In his 19 letters, Rav Hirsch, after paying tribute to what he calls a respected, inspiring personality, has the following to say about Moses Mendelssohn. This commanding individual, who was great chiefly in philosophical disciplines, and who was personally an observant Jew, accomplished this much, that he showed the world and his brethren that it was possible to be a strictly religious Jew, and yet to shine distinguished as the German Plato. This, and yet, was decisive. This is actually going to be the next paragraph we're going to read. Even the most zealous study of the Bible was of no avail for the comprehension of Judaism, because it was not treated as the authoritative source of doctrine and instruction, but only as a beautiful poetic storehouse from which to draw rich supplies for the fancy and the imagination. The Talmud thus neglected, practicing Judaism thus completely uncomprehended, it was but natural that the former symbolization and abstract interpretation of Judaism, which had for a time been interrupted, again became prevalent and was carried to an extreme which threatened to destroy all Judaism. Rav Hirsch was right. Bible study without the Talmud is not only insufficient, it is even dangerous. It is only the Talmud in combination with the Bible which can show us the high road to Judaism. No Jewish philosophy which neglects the study of any detail of our mitzvos can be regarded as genuinely Jewish. Mendelssohn was great, chiefly in philosophical disciplines, in metaphysics and aesthetics, and so he treated the Torah only philosophically and aesthetically. But to quote Hirsch, he did not build up Judaism organically as a science from within itself. And that is exactly what Rav Hirsch did accomplish. Every passage in Talmud, Midrash and Haggadah, and especially the halachic Midrashim, was sacred to him and considered indispensable for anyone who wants to arrive at a true understanding of Jewish life and thought. Thus, in his commentary on the Torah, as well as in his philosophical writings, Rav Hirsch integrated written and oral law, expounding every detail of the halacha and using it for the construction of an imposing edifice of Judaism as a whole. In this way, Torah as ancient Jewish wisdom and Derech Eretz as science and modern civilization did not appear disconnected, but as an integration of the divine message of Judaism with modern surroundings, always to the avoidance of assimilation and the preservation of the primacy of the Torah. More than anyone else, Rav Hirsch understood the deep wisdom of the comment of our sages on the phrase in the Song of Songs, Tovim Dodecha Miyayin, that the words of the oral law are in the end more decisive than the letters of the written law, and he acted accordingly. Therein lies the explanation of the fact that Rav Hirsch succeeded where Mendelssohn failed, that one started a movement which led back into the heart of Judaism, whereas the other, with all good intentions, was destined to head a movement which led out of it, that the followers of Mendelssohn ultimately left the stream of Jewish tradition, whereas the disciples of Rehersh not only remained within it, but mightily enriched the living waters of the eternally flowing river of the Torah. So let's hear a little bit from Rabbi Wein regarding Mendelssohn.
Now, Rehersh attacks Mendelssohn because Mendelssohn divided the world into the religious and the secular. Mendelssohn is, if not the author, but he's the proponent of the idea of Tehei Yehudi Beveisecha Veodom Betseisecha, meaning be a Jew in your home and outside in the street you are a man of the world. My Rebbe Remendel used to say that about the yeshiva man, he said, that became a man of the world. So he used to say that when you needed a yeshiva man, the man of the world would show up. And when you needed the man of the world, up come the yeshiva man, right? But that was the Mendelssohnian idea that somehow you could divide the two things. So Mendelssohn could be at the court of Frederick the Great and never miss davening a mincha, but Mendelssohn in his philosophic and other works, that was a separate issue completely. He was able to compartmentalize it. And if you think about it, there are a lot of Jews like that. Your Jews are able to compartmentalize they're one Jew in the synagogue and they're another Jew in the marketplace. They're one Jew at home and they're another Jew in, you know, they're on vacation or on a cruise. Our ability is that we're able to be schizophrenic. We're able to compartmentalize ourselves. Hirsch fought against that.
And as we've discussed many times, to Hirsch, there's no compartmentalization. You are one whole Jew in everything that you do. Anyway, there are many articles written on Mendelssohn by Torah individuals, and we could say that he was a very complex person. A number of years ago, Rabbi Avi Shafrin, he wrote an article on Mendelssohn that created a lot of controversy. Herr Schwab wrote a response to it, among others, and I have no idea who is correct or isn't. No matter who is or is not correct, it would appear that history has proven that even if Mendelssohn was not completely off, and we'll see Rabbi Elias's note in a few minutes, what came from him certainly was and still is. And although he was given many accolades by the Rabbanim of his time, he in his own life was on a slippery path. And we see that his children and his students were not on any path that would lead to Judaism, but rather on the contrary, many of them were Reform, Christian, or atheists. So let us see Rabbi Elias' note 16. We'll start in the middle. This is on page 298. And he writes, Mendelssohn himself was the first victim of his own teachings. His conviction regarding freedom of rational speculation led him to tolerate around him and to employ as teachers for his children men with clearly heretical views. Indeed, he too, in the privacy of his personal correspondence, expressed totally unacceptable ideas on Tehillim, for example, and in general, he demonstrated a glaring lack of respect for rabbinic authority. Furthermore, the observance of mitzvos in his home, stripped as they were of inner content, was felt to be a burdensome duty, perfunctorily discharged. Moreover, in a number of areas, Mendelssohn arrogated himself to the right to express moral enlightenment views of halachic practices. Mendelssohn apparently also treated Tanakh as poetry. He did not believe it had any real prophetic attribute to it. Let's see, note 17, he writes, Mendelssohn himself set the tone in this regard. I am sure that you will treat the Psalms as poetry and not pay attention to the prophetic and mystical elements which Christian as well as Jewish interpreters have found in them, only because they searched for these elements, having searched for them only because they were neither philosophers nor literary critics. While Mendelssohn was a totally orthodox quote-unquote Jew in his life, his descendants were certainly not. And from the way Rav Hirsch mentions him here, it would appear that Rav Hirsch was of the opinion that he made grave mistakes in his approach. Now, if he personally was or should be considered an apikoros, I do not know. However, if you look through note 16, you'll find that Rabbi Elias has a lot of information on Mendelssohn. Also, if you look online, you could find Rabbi Avi Shafrin's letter, which was very interesting. and there's a lot of information out there on him if anyone would like to look into this matter further. So let us continue. We are on page 269, and we're up to footnote C. Refersch writes, "Do not misunderstand me. I am speaking here only of the overall view of his work for Judaism, his Jerusalem, which defends freedom of thought and belief on Jewish grounds, stresses, in contradistinction to the Mora, that Judaism primarily demands practical action, and it expresses opinions concerning the Eidos which, had they been developed further and then properly comprehended by his successors, might have given a different direction to the period that followed." So Rav Hirsch is saying that even though Mendelssohn demanded practical action over just mere philosophical speculation, right, unlike Rambam, who stresses the philosophical speculation to a very high degree, these ideas were never developed, and the mitzvos were therefore not grounded on anything. But let's continue. "But neither the one thing nor the other occurred. The understanding of Judaism was not developed further by him, and his successors, lacking their master's religious sentiment, were not content to accept the law as eternally binding just because it was divinely proclaimed, and they found no other way to comprehend it than by embracing Maimonides' synthesis." And that's very true. If you look at Reform Judaism, what's the main thing that they stopped doing? It's the mitzvos. Anything practical is put to the side, and it's what I could understand. Now, that's more in line with Rambam. Now, certainly, the Rambam is not a proponent of any of this. That's pretty obvious. But when it comes to the philosophical speculation, the Rambam is considered king. And therefore, they were taking basically what they wanted, and what they wanted was just to do what philosophically they could understand and what occurred to them, as opposed to actually doing the mitzvos. So let's continue on the top. "This and yet was decisive. His followers contented themselves with eagerly furthering the study of Tanakh, along with philosophical and aesthetic lines, studying the Mora, but, at the same time, adding and expanding the studies of humanities." Now, according to Wikipedia, the humanities are academic disciplines which study the human condition using methods that are primarily analytical, critical, or speculative. And this is distinguished from empirical approaches of the natural sciences or social sciences. Now these have always been looked upon with suspicion, or I should say with more suspicion than the natural sciences, even among those that follow Torah and Derech Eretz, because they place man's intellect as being the ultimate. "The proper study of Judaism through Tanakh and Talmud was neglected. Even the zealous study of Tanakh could not lead to an understanding of Judaism, for it was studied not as a source of instruction, conveying values, but as a poetic composition to feed the imagination," as we mentioned earlier. "Considering that the study of Talmud was neglected and practical Judaism was totally uncomprehended, it was but natural that the earlier interpretation of Judaism, which for a time had receded into the background, now had a completely free field and was indeed carried to an extreme that threatened to destroy all Judaism." Now, this earlier interpretation of Judaism, we already mentioned, is based partly on the Rambam and partly on understanding the current intellectual times, that man's knowledge is the ultimate and he has no one to answer to. "If that view of life that considers perception of the truth to be man's cardinal mission should be true, and who could venture to doubt it, seeing that Maimonides had declared it to be so?" Right? We know that Rambam pushes one to reason and perceive truth as far as his human mind will understand him. So if you look through Sefer Mada or parts of the Mora, you see that comes to light. "And, above all, if those views about the demands made of us by the Torah should be true, and who could dare to think otherwise, since Maimonides, the great master of Talmud and of Judaism, put it into practice, had propounded them, then indeed, the many folios of the Talmud contain nothing but nitpicking subtleties. Then, in effect, practical Judaism is nothing but a meaningless bother. Who could avoid coming to such a conclusion?" Now, we said here, if those views about the demands made on us by the Torah should be true, so I think what he's referring to is that Rambam gives hypotheses about many of the mitzvos, and These reasons, in later time periods such as Reform, was an excuse for many people to leave Judaism. Because once I know the intent and the reason of the Torah for a specific mitzvah, why should I bother performing it? And we're about to read something like that right now. If, for instance, the sole intent of the prohibition of labor on Shabbos is to enable man to rest and recover from the toil of the week through cessation of physical activity, in order to give some scope to the mind as well, and who could doubt that this is the intent, since both Moseses interpret it thus, and moreover, it is the purpose of the Christian Sunday, who then would not consider it mere pettiness and hair-splitting to fill an entire folio with investigations about what activities are forbidden on Shabbos? Is it not strange indeed to declare the writing of two letters of the alphabet, surely an intellectual occupation, a capital sin, while many acts involving great physical exertion and all destructive activities are judged leniently? And lo and behold, the hen is forbidden to lay eggs. So clearly this entire paragraph is sarcastic. And if we look at note 19, what are we talking about, the hen here? He writes, this is a sarcastic reference to the ridicule which the maskilim, the advocates of Jewish enlightenment, poured upon halachic detail, in this case upon the Talmudic controversy of whether an egg laid on Yom Tov that falls on Sunday may be eaten that day. As related earlier, when Heinrich Gratz, the historian, was a young man, he was inspired by the broad sweep of ideas in the 19 letters to travel to Oldenburg in order to stay in the author's house and to study with him. But he confided in his diary that he could not understand how a man of such breadth of philosophical erudition could concern himself with tying a handkerchief around his neck on Shabbos in order not to carry it, drinking only kosher milk and not shaking hands with ladies. In view of his failure to grasp that Rav Hirsch's philosophy assigned a central role to the observance of revealed law, it should not surprise us that after leaving Oldenburg, Gratz drifted away from orthodoxy and became a leading figure in the historical school of Judaism, the precursor to today's conservative Judaism. Both his cavalier attitude toward halachic obligations and his emerging views about the evolution of the halacha brought about a complete break with his former mentor. Or, turning to another area, if sacrificial offerings were perhaps meant merely as giving of one's possessions in grateful recognition of the fact that they are divinely granted, and if they were primarily designed with all their varied details merely to constitute a contrast to the then prevalent polyistic sacrificial customs, then indeed it is absurd to fill three or four folios with investigations on how they are to be offered, precisely what parts may be used, which persons may officiate, and at what times. Then indeed, do you not see it? All this is but mind-deadening priestcraft. Consequently, but surely, before drawing conclusions, one ought to have asked himself, Moshe ben Maimon, Moshe ben Mendel, are they in fact Moshe ben Amram? Now, Rav Hirsch is very strong against Rambam, to such an extent that there have been those that kind of shun the 19 letters because he's so strong in the way that he addresses Rambam. And we know Rambam was one of our greatest sages. However, if you look at what Rav Hirsch was fighting, this is it. And he held that it was Rambam's ideas added on to the ideas of Mendelssohn, which really tripped people up. And he was dealing with the fallout of all of that. So it's not surprising to me that he's so strong against what Rambam writes. And as we've explained many times, Rav Hirsch's philosophy is basically diametrically opposed to Rambam's approach. Surely the inconsistency between these theories and the reality of the mitzvah is the most conclusive proof that these theories are not correct, are not founded upon a comprehensive understanding of the mitzvah as a whole, but are imposed on it from without. And we discussed this many times that Rav Hirsch stresses it again and again. The ideas of Torah can only be built upon from within Torah itself. You cannot take outside reasoning in order to understand Torah. And both Rambam and Mendelssohn did such a thing. They took their outside knowledge and imposed it on the Torah, as opposed to creatively building up the Torah from within and using your outside knowledge to assist you in that. The Mora's author himself states that, in analyzing the meaning of the mitzvos, he based himself only upon the Torah Shebiksav, the written law, an approach which he himself would certainly have declared invalid for determining the rules of the mitzvah observance, and which must, therefore, obviously be totally erroneous. He himself states that, in analyzing the mitzvos as their underlying ideas, he disregards their details. Those very details which, together, give the complete picture of the mitzvah, and which, predominantly, are the subject of the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law. Now, Rav Hirshon, building upon Torah ideas from within, he found the details of the mitzvos, which we are so careful about, to be essential. Rambam, on the other hand, disregarded the details and would only examine the overall mitzvah from the standpoint of the written law. And this caused, besides for the issues already discussed, a chasm to develop between the oral and the written law. Now, we already saw Rambam inside in Mor Nevuchim, where Rambam discussed how by Korbanos one should not look at the individual aspects of the mitzvos. So I will refer you back to letter 10, where we discussed Rambam versus Rav Hirsch's approach on the details of the mitzvos. Now, perhaps I should have pointed this out earlier, but lest a person think that this may not be true or not recognized by outsiders, that Rambam really holds this opinion, even though we read it inside, I just want to show it to you from a secular perspective. So we'll take a look in Norman Podoritz's book, where he describes Rambam's use of Aristotle and how the Maskilim made use of it. Now, Norman Podoritz is Jewish, but he's not from, and either way, his book is not meant for a Jewish audience at all. This book is entitled Why Are Jews Liberals? And I think we quoted it once before, and this comes from page 45. He writes, "It was Maimonides himself who had originally made the case for two of the main arguments the Maskilim were bent on advancing. As passionate rationalists who were determined, at least at first, to remain within the Jewish fold, they could take encouragement from the great sage's demonstration that the revealed truths of Judaism were entirely consistent with reason, by which Maimonides meant the philosophy of Aristotle." Now, I also want to point out, and this comes, if you look in Rabbi Elias's note number 5, that it wasn't just Rav Hirsch who highly disagreed with Rambam, but many of the Rishonim and Achronim strongly criticized the Rambam for what they understood to be a dangerous approach. And Reform and others, they latched onto this, and the results we know have been catastrophic. We can sum it up by saying that if the details are not of significant importance, and man's growing and developing intellect can understand the commandments, then it's not a far step to disregard the details and eventually the entire commandment. And look how where Reform is today. They're out of the fold on everything. They vote on what they like in the Torah. They vote on gay marriage. There's no oral tradition, so if you can't understand something, you make it up by committee. The rabbinate has moved to, I think, being a majority of women. It's just out of the fold of traditional Judaism in every way. Just some others who were vocal against Rambam on this specific issue was Yad Ramah, Rameir Abulafia. There was Rabbi Yehuda Alfacher. I don't know if I'm saying the name right, but he has a correspondence with the Radak where he is also critical of Rambam, and Chassid Yaivitz. So let's continue. Surely there must be a meaning in all commandments, and their underlying meaning must be accessible to us, particularly in the case of those commandments that announce their purpose to be educational and introduce themselves to us by their specific appellation. Appellation is an identification. Testimonial, memorial symbol. What if we really tried to uncover their message? If we really conceived of them as testimonials, memorial symbols? Alas, this stage was not reached. Some, indeed, preferred not to reach it, for a mentality had encroached on us from the West, which mocked everything sacred and took malicious joy in ridiculing it. With it came a striving for sensual enjoyment, happy to be rid so easily of burdensome restrictions. Thus one demolished, leveled, and flattened everything. Rabbi Elias writes in 20, "The author is taking aim at the platitudes, carrying with them no obligations, that were substituted for the teachings and injunctions of the Torah. These words are still applicable to the liberal humanistic principles that the reformers of Judaism have substituted for authentic Judaism. I think a great example of this would be Tikkun Olam. Just about everything the reformers do today is based on their conception of Tikkun Olam. It's not based on a Torah conception, it's based on their own misconstrued platitude of what Tikkun Olam is. So at this point we have a long footnote, this is footnote D, and one stating that the Rambam had the incorrect method of research into understanding and the explanations of the mitzvos, so Rav Hirsch now states to a modern enlightened crowd how research must be done into Torah and mitzvos, making use of the scientific method and accounting for the differences of the Torah. So it's an interesting footnote. A word here about the proper method of Torah research. Two revelations are before us, nature and Torah. The same method of investigation must apply to both. In studying nature, all phenomena confront us as given data, and we can only endeavor to find the laws applying to them and their interrelation a posteriori by starting from these phenomena themselves. The proof of the truth of your theory, or rather the probability of its correctness, can be provided only by nature itself, since you will have to test your theory against nature's phenomena in order to be able to state with the highest possible degree of certainty that the facts indeed confirm your assumptions, i.e., that every phenomena observed can be explained according to your theory. In nature, one single contradicting fact can invalidate your theory, and you must, therefore, make sure to obtain as much information as possible about the phenomena that you are studying so that, as far as possible, you will have all the facts at your disposal. Moreover, even where we are not able to ascertain the laws and interrelations governing any given phenomenon, the phenomenon itself remains a fact. All this applies equally to the study of Torah. Just as heaven and earth are facts, so too to us are the Torah and its commandments. In the Torah, just as in nature, the ultimate cause is God. In the Torah, just as in nature, no fact can be denied, even though we may comprehend neither its cause nor its relation to others. Instead, we must persevere in the Torah as in nature to trace God's wisdom which manifests itself in them. In studying the Torah, then, we must begin by accepting the Torah's commandments in their entirety as given facts. In other words, with all the details, just like when you research science, you have to account for all the details along with the whole picture. In the Torah, we do the same thing. We must study them and their relationship to each other and to the aspects of life that they govern. Then, we must test the soundness of our theories by their conformity with the provisions of the law. And here, too, the highest possible degree of certainty is obtained if everything fits our theory. Moreover, just as the phenomena of nature remain facts, even though we may not have found their causes or interrelationships, and just as their existence does not depend on the results of our investigation, rather the reverse is true, so too the commandments of the Torah are law, even if we have not uncovered the cause and interrelationships of even a single one, and our fulfillment of the commandments in no way depends on the results of our investigation. Only the commandments belonging to the category of eidos, which seeks to convey insights and to affect the emotions, remain incomplete without adequate investigation. So at this point, we're going to conclude letter 18, part 3. And in part 4, we're going to discuss Rav Hirsch's method on how we could solve the situation and move forward.